Welcome to the Education Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Journal Club. Here in our PCRF Journal Club, we promote evidence-based practices by critically evaluating the latest science in emergency medical services. We hope our discussion will help advance EMS practice. Through the generous support of our sponsor, Limmer Education, we can make science more accessible and understandable.
Well, hi, everyone, and welcome. And let me forward our slide here before it plays again to the October 2024 Pre-Hospital Care Research Forum Education Research Journal Club. The PCRF, as you know, promotes research literacy to advance the science of EMS educational research. So here with the PCRF Journal Club, we take a closer look at some of the latest research happening in medical education. Big thank you to Limmer Education for sponsoring these podcasts so we can bring you the best of science in education. I'm Megan Corey. I am here with Dr. Bill Toon. Also joining us, Alex Tremblay and Michael Caduce is here, and also maybe dropping in pretty soon because she's here with me is Kim McKenna. So we have a full house here, and we're going to be talking about something really interesting. Remember last month, we talked about AI and its ability, and specifically ChatGPT, its ability to help generate some scenarios for us, generate scenarios and diverse scenarios with diverse patients. So we talked a little bit about that last month, and then this month, we're going to be talking about this article from Medical Teacher, just published this year in 2024. Can ChatGPT generate practice question explanations for medical students? Is this a new faculty teaching tool? So remember, too, and I mentioned the previous episode last month. If you miss any of our episodes, or maybe you have to leave a little bit early, don't forget that you can go to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/@PCRF@UCLA. And remember, you can quote, tag, share, hashtag EMS research or at PCRF at UCLA. If you hear something interesting or if you'd like to link to our show, please do so. Okay. So let's get started. Remember that you can use the chat to put your questions in. I can't guarantee that I can see them, but somebody can see them and bring them into our conversation as we go. So also, we'd love to hear your experiences with AI, both positive and negative. We hear a lot of negative stuff lately, but we know that there's actually some potentially positive things that could come out of this for faculty as well as for students. So let's talk about this article, though, and a little bit of background. We know that there's proven strategies in teaching and learning. We talk about that on this podcast and in this journal club. We've looked at some studies that are around some best practices in teaching and learning that will promote specifically long-term retention and good outcomes in the long run. One of those is retrieval practice, and that's basically practice testing through the use of practice tests, retrieving that information, on a consistent basis, especially if the student is provided with specific feedback. So retrieval practice, specific feedback, kind of like deliberate practice, only instead of procedural skills, we're talking about deliberate retrieval practice in the cognitive domain. But it takes time to develop these practice questions. So most of the time in this background in this article talks about the use of the development of questions in standardized tests like National Registry, for example, but they use the examples that are in medical education. So those standardized tests, as we know, the high stakes licensing exams, those involve committees and validation, test question validation. Whereas, if we're developing practice tests at a college or at your education program, you're probably developing multiple choice tests. Maybe you and a faculty group are developing some questions and then, kind of internally validating them through test item review or something like that. But we also know that a best practice is to provide feedback under each of those items. So if you're developing a multiple choice test, they always say the best practice is to have feedback for each of the selections. So if the student selects the right answer, they get an explanation as to why it was the right answer, validation based upon the objectives of the question. And if they get the wrong answer, some type of explanation as to why this isn't the answer. So those explanations, as we know, take a long time. And so we know that emerging, you know, artificial intelligence has the potential to support faculty in a number of ways. And actually, before we talk about this particular study, I wanted to just ask our panel here, you know, how have you guys been using AI in terms of helping you, you know, with efficiency as a faculty member, as a teacher?
Megan, I'm so glad you picked this article. I really enjoyed reading it, and I so appreciated in the introduction when they're like, it's so time consuming to write the right answer. And I think it is. And to the point of like the student benefit is the number of questions we get oftentimes in class, like I saw this test question and I got it wrong, but I don't know why. That feedback is so helpful for students and really helps eliminate some of those questions. So I love that they're using ChatGPT to help with that. We'll see if it's right or not here or wrong. I think there's a huge opportunity to use AI in our classrooms. And actually, I really appreciate when we were talking about AI creating the medical vignettes last time. And so that was an interesting article. We're using it now to create images for our case studies. So if I need a farmhouse, or more importantly, like a patient, like make me a 63-year-old male who looks like he's having some shortness of breath. If you really want to diversify your sims, instead of just using Google Images, you can say like, give me a 63-year-old Hispanic, you know, man who appears to be short of breath or who appears to be in pain, who's diaphoretic and pale. It'll generate you those pictures that you can, and you can sort of repatriate them as you, until you get the one you want. But it's really helpful to do some of those things that I'm enjoying using it to make those scenarios.
Yeah. And they used, I think, in that last study, ChatGPT and Adobe Firefly together to get images for their scenarios. So, Alex, how about you?
You know, the biggest application in teaching that I've used it for at the undergraduate level is to make sure that people aren't using it to generate their papers. We do use a significant AI detection. And it's pretty good. One of the problems is that there are things out there like Grammarly that are great. They're great for students who maybe really struggle with sentence structure or with semicolons and things. And it flags it as AI generated because it's got this AI overlay. Those have been kind of the biggest uses. I work primarily in the public sector in government. And in government, we are extremely limited on what we're able to use AI for. Yeah. We are not able to, you know, feed it data and ask. But I do find it in my personal life beneficial for like writing SQL codes. And things like that, like, hey, I wrote this SQL query and it didn't work. I'm trying to access this database. Why didn't it work? And it fixes it almost every time. So
I never even thought about that.
Yeah,
I know.
It's awesome.
I know another faculty that I work with has used it to help write grant applications, mostly because of writer's block, you know, getting at least a start on something. And I think that some of that happens with test banks to a degree. And maybe those of you who teach would agree. And Bill, this kind of gets to maybe when we first started teaching, really what you had were maybe publishers' test banks or other test banks. And that could, even though, you know, there's a lot of critique about them and that they're not validated tests all the time. And you could still use them as a starting point, as a launch point, and then, you know, have some discussion over whether or not this question, you know, is a critical thinking level and could we make it critical thinking level and other things. So, yeah, I think that there now we have this tool that can actually speed up and make more efficient a process. And they did hypothesize in this. And well, let's look at what they actually did. This was at Boston University. This was in medical school. They didn't, the subjects were not the students, the subjects here were the questions. So they wanted to evaluate the accuracy of ChatGPT in answering faculty created practice questions and then compare the explanations in terms of thoroughness and in terms of accuracy of the ChatGPT generated explanations to the faculty provided explanations. So the faculty would you know, create these test questions, but they'd have an objective. They'd have several key or major points that would go with each of the explanations. And then they essentially fed the questions into ChatGPT, had them, you know, basically take the test and then to generate explanations for each of the responses. This was their objective, and essentially, these were first and second year pre-clerkship med student practice questions that were developed by the faculty. So what they did was they randomly selected 15 practice questions from each of the modules. And you'll see the modules coming up here. There were three foundational modules, and we'll see what's in each of those foundational modules. That I would assume that would be first year. And then there are subject-specific specialty modules, cardiology, pulmonology, endocrinology, reproductive. There are specialty modules. So they separated them out. They said they randomly selected 15 practice questions from each module. I think they couldn't get 15 from the first foundation because there weren't enough of them that had all the explanations in there because, again, faculty didn't have time to. They did exclude questions with images and graphs, which immediately made me think that there goes the EKG questions and the capnography waveform questions, anything that involved an image. They did exclude those to start off. And again, this is a kind of a preliminary study. They did look back and say that, you know, or they did provide some references that there were, you know, other studies that had ChatGPT take standardized tests and actually pass or get a score of, I think, in the 60, mid 60s. So standardized, you know, medical tests. So this is, you know, in that case, it's not terribly new that this is, but the explanations is the novelty of this, looking at the faculty generated questions and then looking at their explanations and how can ChatGPT measure up. So what they did was they measured, and you can see here, they have faculty generated questions in the pre-clerkship years. They got 94 total test questions. And they did what's called a first pass. So pass one performance, looking at kind of their accuracy, how many were correct versus incorrect. Then if they got them incorrect, they took a second pass. And after that second pass, how many were correct and incorrect, they took the questions that were correctly answered on both first and second pass. In this case, that was 87 of them. And then if they excluded at that point any questions that didn't have any faculty generated answers, again, probably due to time, and that was six of them. So they ended up with 81 of these questions. And what they evaluated then was the comparison between ChatGPT's generated explanations versus the faculty generated explanations. And how, what did they do with those? Well, they reviewed them. So two authors reviewed the generated explanations versus the faculty explanations, and they gave them scores. A score of zero was if the explanation provided by ChatGPT was not matching the faculty points or it had misinformation or misidentification in there. Score one would have some of the key points and no misinformation. And then a score of two would have all the key points involved or that matched the faculty explanations. So this was the way that it was laid out and the study. And did you guys have any questions about this or any input about, you know, how it was laid out or any questions about, like, you know, the way ChatGPT would generate an explanation?
I actually thought this was one of the most easy to follow method sections I've read in a while. I was like, oh, this isn't too hard. The one thing that I caught that I thought was interesting was, so if it got the question wrong, they would tell it the correct answer.
Yes.
Or the explanation. I was sort of thinking in my mind, like, why wouldn't you just tell it, like, it's wrong, can you guess again? I guess at that point in time, it's just sort of like a guess and check method, and that's probably not an effective way to validate it. But I did think it was interesting that they said, you know, and answer choice A is correct, please provide the explanation to C. I would not have necessarily come up with that methods in my head, but these methods were very straightforward and easy to follow, which was kind of nice for a change.
Yeah, strong methodology. Yeah.
And it still got it wrong, too, after saying the answer is A. So there was still, you know, some, what was it, seven... things that were incorrect even after telling the answer. So I'm still trying to wrap my head around how to run it.
Mostly in pulmonology. It seems like pulmonology was the big break. And I think the question becomes, right? So large language models just, they suck in the whole internet and they spit out an answer, right? That's essentially their functionality, because you have other mm-hmm. types of AI that are exclusionary AI. Like, I'm giving you this information, tell me what's not right. This is what I'm giving you this information, tell me what's correct. Mm-hmm. When I look at, like, they got cardiology right a lot. There's a lot of, like, really great and well-written blogs that are super easy for a large language model to process, like Steve Smith's EKG blog and things like that. Versus when you think about pulmonology, like, our paramedics struggle with it. Would make sense that large language model struggles with it, because it's a far more complex than some of these other more well-defined topics.
I thought this was an interesting table as well. And I was surprised that Foundations One, which is, like, I think biochemistry, because I thought the same thing. I was like, there seems to be a lot of information out there, and it seems like it would be hard to mess that up. Though I do wonder if there's any statistical significance. I if there's only 84 questions, they're separated among these categories, like, there's probably not a huge difference in how many I got right or wrong per subject matter. So I sort of reminded myself of that, like, maybe it makes a difference. I would have thought that pulmonology, there's plenty of good information on breathing. So I don't know, but it seems to me like there's not that much information on oncology, which I think is Foundations Three. And yet I got those questions right. So I was like, well, maybe there's more on the internet explaining oncology and treatment for cancer than there is breathing. I don't know. I thought it was interesting.
Yeah. So what we're jumping into here is the results, the first pass results of the first versus second pass by ChatGPT. And we can see from this table, you've separated out by the three foundations groups: Foundation One, which is biochemistry and genetics, like Michael was saying, and Foundations Two is histology and anatomy. Foundations Three, immunology, pharmacology, biology, microbiology, and oncology. And then you have the separated out specialties: pulmonology, cardiology, hematology, endocrine and reproduction, and then the total. So looking at the total, because that's where you get the, the 80 something questions, the first pass, basically first pass success. Can we call it first pass success? Was 75%. So ChatGPT, if that's our first pass success, passes our general faculty generated questions. And the second pass is 94. So that's after being told the answer, we get the second pass at 94. Just looking at the first pass, second pass, and this is what I believe you're saying, Michael, the sample size in each one of these is going to be small. And they listed this in the limitations. And also in the beginning, they were selecting randomly 15 questions from each of the areas. And Foundations One had fewer than 15 questions. So, that's what we're talking about here in terms of the percentage, is a percentage out of 15 questions within each, if I'm understanding it right. It did surprise me, though, even if the difference, if you did increase the numbers and the difference was real, that, anatomy and histology doesn't exactly, even if you search the internet, I wouldn't imagine it would change much. So that kind of surprised me a little bit.
I think you're spot on, Megan. And again, like, I looked at these and I was like, okay, what does this mean? I'm not sure it's as much, though. I did think it was interesting that you saw the first pass success was lower, then the second choice was lower. And that's sort of what I think reasonably assume would happen as well. So I think as we very quickly jumped into the methods, I thought that made sense to me, and sort of in my mind that sort of passes my sniff test, that this study did sort of get what it was needing. Was if you didn't get the first choice right, then it was less likely to give you the right answer choices. And I sort of thought back, okay, as an educator, what does that mean for me? I thought to myself, okay, that means I should probably go back and maybe look at the question. Maybe I wrote it in a way that the stem is not clear or it's not pulling it. Now, I know in this study, they did look at that as well and sort of looked mm-hmm. at some of the questions to evaluate for the stem. So I wondered too, gosh, you could redesign this same study and have, like, multiple faculty review the question, almost like a little bit of a modified Delphi or something. Yeah. And then you could sort of clarify your stems. And I wonder if ChatGPT would perform better. I don't know. That was what I was thinking. I also was thinking, I wonder if ChatGTP can't answer it and get it right, I wonder if there's any correlation to, like, an item analysis for your students. Would that similarly be a low performing question? So it'd always be interesting to actually test those questions and see if, like, no, it's just ChatGPT gets it wrong, or like, no, ChatGPT and the students got it wrong. Maybe it's not a great question, or maybe it's just a tough question, which you could tell by like a point by serial or something like that. So I don't know. That was my question. Was like, gosh, I wonder if you actually tested this on students, if they would perform similarly to ChatGPT or not.
Yeah. Bill?
I liked it a great deal, but the biggest thought that comes to me, and they brought it out in here, is that this is evolving very rapidly every month, probably. And I think that it as a tool to help people, particularly instructors, be more efficient, use their time more wisely, whatever it might be. And I just think what we it is I think in my mind is, where are the barriers? Not barriers, but where is the roadway we want them to stay within, traveling down? Is there what's the ethical issues with using this kind of technology? The accuracy again of it, there's been lots of talk about that, biases and just some of the wrong stuff, but I think that's all going to be worked out. A year from now, it's going to be entirely different. 5 years from now, I can't even begin to imagine what it's going to be like. But I do think it's important that we find a way to integrate this, not only for our own use, but students to become more efficient at consuming material and getting good. Maybe they can develop their own practice type stuff or study sheets. The potential is phenomenal, but I still think it would be wise for a learning institution to have a statement, in their syllabi or whatever that talks about uses, inappropriate uses, and just has, barriers on the roadway so people know how to utilize this. But this is needs to be the same for the educators and stuff. But this is just going to get better and better. It's not going to get worse.
Well, I'm hoping too. It's an efficiency thing and even a safety thing. So we've mentioned this before, and last time I think we talked a little bit about this. It would be great to be able to call out what's going on with your patient, and then have, whoever, ChatGPT, Siri, Alexa, whoever, say that your patient has a GCS of X, and you're just, doing the evaluation, or you're just saying something out loud. I have a 4-year-old. In whatever, you're going to drop this much medication. Just something that will, reduce cognitive load, just like reducing the load on the faculty here, of helping you get things done, but you still have to step in. And actually, their hypothesis was that, the ChatGPT generated explanations, which we're going to get to now, would be, comparable and fulfill the explanations of the faculty generated question explanations. And but that you would still require, it would still require some faculty vetting. And that's, I think, what the key is. And I think the same goes for students. So I recently had an experience too, where I've, I teach a hybrid courses, and the discussion forum is pretty flexible. It's a case-based. I want to hear your synthesis of, what we've been talking about in class versus what you're seeing on the case. And it's, you can see that some people have just plugged this right into ChatGPT, and they're generating, or even Google, they're just generating a bunch of stuff. Because now, of course, if you Google it, you get a little AI response at the top. And so it'll, you can tell. And I usually say that I kind of want to hear your voice. And there's always going to be that, I'm going to be standing right before you when we're running simulation. I can ask you directly, and they're not going to be ChatGPT standing there with you. So that there's always that piece of it as well. But so getting to the results of the explanation performance. So what we just looked at was how ChatGPT basically did on the first and second pass, and in each of the categories. And I would say too, in cardiology, this comes up as well. What we're seeing here is the ChatGPT explanation performance compared to the faculty generated responses based on those scores we went through. So in total, we had the 81 questions, and you could see about 65% of them had, scored a 2, meaning they had all the elements and no misinformation at all, as the faculty explanations. About 27% scored one, which meant, and it was, I think it's a little bit alarming that there's misinformation. So there's some, you know, there's one thing for, you know, lacking information. There's another thing about having misinformation. And then score zero, as we said, you know, having the misinformation and not the elements that the faculty, none of the elements that the faculty had put in. So even with, these are all questions that were answered correctly, on both pass one and pass two. And, you know, I'm wondering if that, if pass two, and actually we see this in the next one, pass two is where we see that score of zero appear more. But when you look again in each of the categories, and I know they're small numbers, but if you look in each of the categories, we can see cardiology really stands out as the one, 93% of them had all of the elements. And what I'm wondering is, does it reflect standardization? Is there more, you know, if you're looking at a ton of information on the internet, is there more standardization in cardiology than there is in some of the other fields? So I'm wondering what you guys think of that. I mean, are you more likely to find, it depends upon the questions too. Incidentally, this had supplements. This article had supplements that went with it, but this is not an open access article. I apologize for that, but I was able to, and those of you who have never done this, I was able to just email the author and the author sent me the article. So, they may not be able to make our podcast, but they'll send you their article and usually give you more explanation about it. But I wasn't able to secure the supplemental material, which gave you some examples of questions. But I'm wondering what you guys think about that standardization.
There's got to be something to that, right? Like the algorithm is looking for sort of single line consistency. So I would imagine that that's likely what that means. Again, I go back to, I wonder if it's in the question, because I also got the paywall when I tried to get the supplement. And so I wonder if there's something in a couple of those questions. I don't know if the same author wrote the same questions, which may lead to some of that. The other thought I have is I'll oftentimes ask ChatGPT to provide citation for what it's telling me, like provide me a response in three citations. That might be another way. If I were going to do this in the classroom, I would say, you know, explain the right answer and provide the citation. So I'm not having to write it. I can read it and then I can sort of review where it got that information from so that it's not, I'm like, oh, it's, you know, an article I trust, or, oh, that's a, you know, not a source that I would consider reliable. That's something I've done with ChatGPT that I thought might help in these questions.
Famously has had a handful of scandals about making false references, right? That there's the lawyer that had the issue where like it made fake case law. I've used it as a way to fix my Boolean searches during my literature review for my dissertation. I've said, can you find me an article that contains these key phrases? And it's like, yeah, here's an article that doesn't exist. Now, that's not to say that it hasn't gotten better, right? Or that potentially it does exist and I couldn't find it. But I think you do have to ask, especially because it has access to the whole internet. And as we've learned, like disinformation is both deadly and prevalent. And so I think, it too could fall victim to disinformation, because I can't say for sure, but I imagine that these do prioritize like high website traffic too, right? That they look for places where people get their information. So, but I think I cut off, Michael.
That's interesting. I mean, what is the algorithm for ChatGPT? Is it by, you know, frequency of context? And if you guys can see any of the chat stuff, if you could bring it in, I can't see it from my end without messing with the screen. You don't want me to do that because I'll mess everything up. Where does the information come from, and how does it prioritize information? It's got to prioritize it somehow, because again, this cardiology, even though it's a small number, compare that to the foundations. All three of the foundations are kind of all over the place. Especially like foundation, I think it's, all of them are pretty much all over the place. Foundation two, again, you know, histology and anatomy, what could vary? I don't understand why that would be so all over the place, except that, and if you combined all three of those are basically first year med student hard sciences, essentially, with a little bit of application in foundations three, but such variability in terms of explanation. I think that's interesting. Bill?
I think you sort of touched on it. It is material that is old.
Mm.
And it may not be out there in the internet to the same degree something like cardiology is. Because look at Heart Association and all the work that they do and the articles that, from their websites and everything like that that are out there, the American Journal of Cardiology and stuff like that versus, and this is just a theory, I don't know it for sure, but maybe that's the issue. Maybe it's because, as you said, it is foundational material. There isn't that much that's been rewritten or published, because there's these traditional textbooks that people use and they haven't switched stuff over to the internet. So that could explain why it doesn't have the ability to reference as well or find the sources out there. This is just me listening to you. And I was just, well, could this be the possibility?
So true. And I didn't even think of that, but that makes a lot of sense. Where did they get their sources in the first, especially the first two foundations where, and foundation two, especially where it's, fundamentals, and why would they not be consistent? It does strike me too, Bill. It's kind of bothering me lately that when students do background searches for, like they're developing a research question, they do a background search. We're always telling them, and you hear this sort of in general, just look in the last, 10 or 15 years, do a search, but you only want to do a literature search within the last 10 or 15 years. The problem with that is then people keep coming up with these studies that they say this is the first time this has ever been done. And more I'm seeing this where I'm thinking in the audience, yeah, it has. It was done like 25 years ago, but it was small and maybe you didn't see it. And so I'm curious if you've run into that, Bill.
Well, I've particularly seen that as I've been doing this, my little side project, my personal project on EMS history. And there are some amazing articles around between 1950 and 1960 leading up to the establishment of what became CPR.
Yeah.
That people don't go back that far, but that is more foundational than historical stuff about it. And you're right. If I'm trying to do current research about the latest thing, I'm not going to go back that far. But from a historical perspective, I'm going back that far. And it's fascinating. It's just amazing. And I have to say, I continue to be amazed at the depth of knowledge that did exist at the time. Certainly not as what we know now, but what they, if you think of the context of 1900, what they understood about anatomy and physiology and shock. Mm-hmm. And it's pretty darn amazing. It wasn't as Stone Ages as we may think it is compared to now it is, but at the time it was cutting edge medicine.
Mm-hmm.
Really fascinating. So yes, yeah. I can see that happening very easily.
Yeah. And, speaking of physiology, that's one of the things that they interpreted when they looked at these results was looking at these scores. And they said they felt that some of the ones that had greater amounts of physiology in them, like cardiology, the questions. And again, we can't see these questions because we couldn't get the supplement example. They didn't give all the questions, but they gave a couple of examples. So it does depend upon the test item. But, the ones that had greater physiology that involved more steps and processes and those things actually were the ones that were more accurate, which I thought was interesting. I would have thought they were more complex and they would, require more, they'd maybe miss more often. The other thing I was thinking of when Mike was talking earlier, and he had to leave, but we really appreciate him being on, was that when he talked about ChatGPT getting so much from the internet, getting all of these different sources. And Alex, when you were talking about this, the one thing I thought about was, does that include things like podcasts and blogs and all of these other things? Because if that's the case, I would think that this would be all over the place because, especially in cardiology, because you see, heads up CPR. And I guess it depends upon the question, But we see so much variability out there. You know, do you give epinephrine? I am in a cardiac arrest. All of these different, you know, maybe they stayed away from treatment. This is first 2 years of med school, so that could be telling too. So, Alex, I don't know if you have any thoughts about that. I mean, I don't know much about
I was unable to find any sort of like reasonable explanation of what they do. And it's new and they probably don't have to share, like, this is our large language model and this is what we do. Mm. But to get ready for today, I was trying to see, like, would they include a blog source? Would they include a, like, do they look at peer-reviewed articles? Can they get around a paywall? I presume that not, right? Just like we can't. So,
oh yeah, true. I never thought about that.
Yeah, but I was unable to verify any of that. So I don't want to speak out of turn.
Yeah. And they scan an abstract. So they, really no idea what is ChatGPT looking at. Okay, so then this is the comparison of ChatGPT generated explanations by first and second pass. So we're seeing the ones that were correct on the first pass versus the ones correct on the second pass. And the explanations were compared between the questions that were between the first and second pass. They looked at the differences in scores, and so you see that the scores at the second pass are lower than you see in the first pass attempt. And I think this is what Mike was talking about. How would I interpret this? And as a faculty, it might make me look, especially after the two passes, make me look at the question stem, the item itself. So it may be sort of a way to detect that we need to revisit an item as well. So I wonder how easy this was to do, practically speaking, you know, to feed something into ChatGPT. Is it a matter of, you know, take this test, cut and paste, and provide explanations for the answer, and that's it? So I don't know if you have any experience using ChatGPT for that, Alex or Bill. Have you even used ChatGPT for anything? Not to call you out for ageist, but or myself out.
The simple answer is I've used it once, and that's it. So I have very limited experience.
Me too.
And I believe that, you know, you talked about all those certification agencies that are out there and everything. I can't say 100% for sure, but I don't think they're allowed, or their policies don't let them use any kind of AI in their development of their technology or questions. I can't answer that 100% for sure, but that would be another interesting sidebar if any of those organizations are doing something like that.
And those policies are coming out fast and furious, right? Because it changes, like Bill said earlier, every week. I think it changes almost every day. But you know, Megan, you said, like, Google has Gemini now, so when you ask Google a question, it gives you a Gemini response whether you want it or not. Bing has a similar thing. I think it's called Copilot. Yeah, there's no way anymore, I think, to get around it. And it's like kind of insipid nature of like just kind of working its way into our lives. And that's, I think, in a number of ways, it's good. Mm-hmm. But like as somebody that works in government too, as well as working on the street, like I always think of myself as the question of like, what do people want? Do students want a question written by their professor? Do they want something from a test bank? Or do they want something that is literally could change based on the day that you enter the prompt into a large language model because new research comes out? Do people want to be governed using data informed by AI? The answer right now is probably no. There's not a lot of research out there, but you know, that's not what people vote for. They don't vote for computers, at least as far as I know. So, yeah. I think the other thing I did want to point out here is that this is a short, this is not a full research article. And since we're talking about results, they used an unpaired chi-squared goodness of fit test for this. Okay. This is how they got their p-values down at the bottom, a really good p-value that the odds of this data occurring randomly in a sample is sub 0.1%. However, an unpaired chi-square test, if you've not run one before, is only asking you about two variables. So it's a yes-no test. There's no variance involved. So is it likely that this variable affects this variable? Yes or no? And so I would caution that as accurate as they found this to be, one, they used a subjective scale, 2 points, 1 point, or 0 points. And two, the test that they used methodologically is challenging. So I think it's a really good article, and I think it begs a lot of really cool questions, and it's early research on a very important topic. But I do want to caution taking this to your co-faculty and being like, we should use it, right? Because the data that came out is unclear of benefit, I would say.
Yeah, I see this and I think we should research it.
Right.
It's hypothesis generating. Other things can we learn from this? But it is still very intriguing.
Yeah.
And it's very interesting. But again, even repeating what these folks did in 5 years could probably be all done by some kind of AI program, you know? So it's fascinating what can be, what's going to come out of all of this. So, I don't want to condemn because I think it's really thought provoking what they did here, but I'm not going to draw these amazing conclusions. Look at all the discussion we've just had.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is one thing too, to what Alex was saying, is you not only have the subjective, categories, you also have the subjective authors who are creating those, categories, the 0, 1, and 2. So there's all of that, the introduction of bias. And they do, they have a great section toward the end about the results. One of their findings one of the things they brought up, and I guess we were just talking about this, but that the incorrectly answered questions by ChatGPT, when it says that are due to factual misinformation, some errors can be attributed to misleading question stems. And I think Alex again, or Michael was talking about that early, which can arise given these questions are designed by individual faculty rather than a team of expert reviewers. So they do have, a reference for that. The other thing is it talks about, offering insights for students on how to best utilize ChatGPT for their own immediate learning. And I think the learning part is the key. I really think this flips assessment and evaluation on its head a little bit. It's getting challenging to know, the use of practice tests is something that we started off this whole discussion saying that the use of practice tests was something that we know has a foundation in evidence. It's retrieval practice. It's deliberate cognitive retrieval practice that can help, especially with feedback, that can help students with long-term retention. And now we have to raise the question of if a student can, if they're, what is it they want? Basically, what Alex was saying, what does a student want? If what they want is a good grade and they would like to, or they don't have the time, which a lot of them, are working and taking care of families and doing other things, and they get nervous about that, they may have this tendency to use ChatGPT or one of the other programs to get that score and then kick the can down the road. I'll just learn it later, which is definitely detrimental to their education. So this is one of the things I think that's a challenge going forward, is it kind of flips assessment and our ability to assess students on its head a bit. So Kim just walked into the room. Hey, Kim. And the other thing that was in here, and actually, I think there was something here about we were looking at about making about faculty reflection, about reflecting on your test generation, on your assessment, and your assessment processes of students, and how to move forward with that. The other thing they do explain in that whole results section and the discussion section, they talk about how, sometimes ChatGPT's explanation will lack those key objectives, learning objectives that we find. And that's really important, because mapping a test question is so critical. Mapping it will help you not just validate, but also will help you with, you know, the reliability of a question. Can we map it to something, and is it clearly mapped to an out a learning objective, something that we want students to walk away with? How important this concept is. Anyway, that's that. That was something. The other thing that we have not mentioned, and this has been mentioned a couple of times in articles that we've reviewed that have to do with AI-generated anything, is the harmful racial and gender biases that can be perpetuated if we don't carefully monitor them. Again, the internet being what it is, we don't know, you know, how much of that will be regenerated. So that usually goes into test question and item review. Those were really the key points here. So that's this study. I don't know if you guys have any final thoughts or anything more about the use of ChatGPT for tests.
I think just that it's coming and we have to be prepared. And I think one of the other things is so if you're looking to use it as a tool, it's just as good as a Phillips screwdriver. Sometimes you need a flathead, right? And so if you get an answer or here's my rationale for picking C in this case, in the case of this study, you still have to check it, right? And so you have to weigh, is it faster for me to input the prompt, ask for the explanation, ask for the citation, or for me to say, here's the explanation, here's the textbook we're using. I think that would be my only like big hesitation. I think it's coming. I am reviewing like 6 textbooks right now to pick one for a class. And I have a strong suspicion that a couple of them have test banks that were written by a large language model rather than being written by a person. And I would imagine that as we see more textbooks hit the market that have been written in the last year to 2 years, that's going to continue to be the case. And so I think papers like this build hypotheses for us to do research in the future, which we should always do, and also helps us beg those questions when we work with our publishing partners and things like that.
Thanks. Bill?
Yes. Everything he said, I really agree with it. I'm thinking of how the publishers are going to potentially use this in the future. And there's actually a saving for the publishers to do it. Because instead of paying the, you know, author, and the author will probably go, yeah, I don't have to do those questions anymore. You know, they'll use this. And I imagine there are some of the, to my understanding, some of the fancier AIs, they could input all the text from their textbook and it would generate for them exactly what they need and stuff. So someone's knocking at my door, so let me go check on that. But regardless, I enjoyed this discussion and this article.
Thank you. Thanks, Dr. Toon. And Kim McKenna is joining us as a comment, listening to our discussion.
So I was just going to say that, you know, many of us are terrified about AI and whether it's going to be used for good or for evil. But I feel like it does offer the opportunity to kind of extend the instruction. And this offers some suggestions. I mean, learners could take questions from the already prepared, you know, publisher materials or practice quizzes or anything that you give them, and, you know, put the question in and say, this is the right answer. Ask ChatGPT, why is this the right answer? And so it doesn't even, you know, have to be a structured activity that an instructor would prepare in advance, that you can teach the learners how to use it in a way that could really extend their understanding of something that you've talked about in class or some practice materials that you've given them. So I think that just the more that we learn about it as faculty, the more we'll be able to use the tool for good.
Yeah.
And then teach the learners how to use it for good. Because if we don't teach them how to use this, it would be sort of like not teaching somebody how to use computer skills. They're going to have to know it for their workplace in the future. So it's part of what we're going to have to be teaching as we go along.
With thunderous applause from Dr. Tian. Yeah, I just was thinking, what a great student project.
And it is, but we're going to have to, she touches on something that's so critically important. This is how do we, with this us olders, how do we help them with all of this, you know, new learning technology and stuff that's coming out? And I'm rather grateful that I don't have to do that, you know, for myself, but I do need to understand it. I need to have a good comprehension of it and stuff. And I think we do need to, so it can be done, as she said, for good, because there's also could be, you know, a cheating side of this and all sorts of other aspects of it. So we have a responsibility to do the best that we can. But thank you, Kim, as always, such sage advice.
Yes, the mobile tutor, ChatGPT. All right, well, we're going to end a little bit early, we want to thank you for joining us. Join us next time. Remember, on Friday, November 22nd, we are going to be talking, and hopefully we're going to grab some of these well-known authors that are in this study, which is the SmartSim study, a multi-center prospective randomized trial of 3D virtual reality versus traditional patient simulation. That's on the next PCRF Education Research Journal Club. So join us next, let's see, November 22nd, pretty soon. But you can join Tony and Remley for their clinical journal club, which right now is scheduled for Monday, November 11th. That is Veterans Day. I'm not sure if they're actually doing it that day. Sometimes we reschedule, but double check on that website.
But it's on Narcan and cardiac arrest. So
oh, it is. That's would, oh, good, good.
Oh, that's and then good. She says it's November 18th or something.
Is it a different one now, November 18th? Okay, let me make sure. It's November 18th. I thought maybe that would be rescheduled. So apologies for that. It's November 18th. Yeah. But that sounds like a really good one too. Narcan
it will be.
And cardiac exactly. arrest. All right. So we'll see you next time. And remember, you can go to prehospitalcare.org. And don't forget, if you miss anything, you can go to the YouTube channel and check out all of our past webinars, podcasts, whatever we're calling them. Happy chat GPTing, everyone.
We hope you have enjoyed and learned from this PCRF Journal Club. Please share it with other interested EMS professionals. An archive of past journal clubs can be found at www.pcrfpodcasts.org. You can also find us on Facebook at PCRF at UCLA and on our website at www.prehospitalcare.org. A special thank you to our sponsor, Limmer Education, providing education tools for success at every stage of your EMS journey.